I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today we have two guests on the show, J.L. Powers, who is an author we're familiar with here at Words on a Wire and in El Paso. She actually received her MFA from UTEP a few years before I arrived, so I didn't meet her through that program. I met her by being a writer. You go to these writers' conferences, you go to book fairs, and I ran into her quite a bit, and now I consider her a friend. And her brother, M.A. Powers, is an onychological scientist. And I have to admit, I didn't really know what that was at first when I was reading the bio. And that's kind of embarrassing because I should know. I had to look it up. And it's somebody who studies cancer and cancer patients. It's a very interesting job for a writer because, as you know, writers need to go there. They need to go into the darkness a bit. And I imagine being around that kind of grief and that kind of human emotion and studying it has really deepened his understanding of the human spirit and the human psyche. So I'm excited to talk to him. And of course, I'm always excited to have Jessica on the show. She lives in Livermore, California, and that is the town that I used to live in when I came of age. I moved there when I was about 11 years old, and I moved out when I was 16. So very significant memories reside in Livermore, California. Back when I lived there, it was a small working class town. There were cowboys and there were Mexicans, and that's about it. Now, I recently went back to do a reading at a local library there, and it has grown into this incredible hipster Northern California, very hip town with gluten-free stoplights and fair trade coffee. And walking through that town is like a scene from The Truman Show, you know, that movie where Jim Carrey played somebody who was actually a subject of a TV show, and they always showed the town and it was cute, and people were, old men with straw hats would be sitting out in cafes and they would be talking and drinking coffee, and it was just such a cute little beautiful town. Anyway, I'm excited to talk to both of them, so stick around and we will talk about their new novel, Broken Circle, J.L. Powers and M.A. Powers. J.L. Powers is the author of three young adult novels, The Confessional, This Thing Called the Future, and Amina. She is also the editor of two collections of essays and an author of a picture book, Colors of the Wind. She is also an editor for Cinco Puntos Press. Broken Circle is the first novel she ever wrote with her brother. And her brother is M.A. Powers, and he has a PhD in oncological sciences from the Huntsman Cancer Institute at the University of Utah. He is currently a stay-at-home dad, and I suppose now we can say a stay-at-home novelist. He lives in Maine, and this is the first novel he ever wrote, and the first book he ever wrote with his sister, obviously. J.L. and M.A., welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And one of you is in Maine right now, as in not in Old Maine, which is a building here at the University of Texas, El Paso, but you're in the state of Maine. Is that right, Matt?
That's right, although I have been in Old Maine myself. I graduated from Utah.
I did not know that.
Yes, I am an alumni.
Wow, that's awesome. You and Jessica are from El Paso? I always forget that until I see Jessica's area code, and it's a 915 area code. It's like, oh yeah, she's from El Paso. But I guess I should have made the connection, your brother and sister. And Jessica, we're talking to you from, you're in California right now, yes?
That's correct.
So this is really a strange case, if you ask me. You have co-written a novel, and not only must it be incredibly difficult to co-write in the first place, but your brother and sister. And I tell you, I can't even have a conversation with my sister without us getting in a fight. How did this happen?
People ask all the time, and you didn't kill each other?
But did you? At least at sometimes, did you guys fight about commas and fight about images and fight about character twists?
Disappointingly, not even a little bit.
Oh, nice. It was just flowed right from the beginning. Tell us how it happened, how it came about.
Well, I'll tell about how it happened from my perspective, and then maybe Matt can chime in.
Sure.
I've been writing for a really long time. And when Matt was finishing up his PhD in the microbiology and the oncology sciences, he and his wife decided that as a doctor, she was probably better positioned to bring home the bacon. And so he would be a stay-at-home dad with their, at that point in time, they were expecting their second. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, here he is, he's finishing up his PhD in sciences. He's going to be a stay-at-home dad. He's maybe going to be a little bit bored. And it's lovely and wonderful being home with your kids, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
But you still need that kind of creative outlet or that intellectual outlet of some sort. And so it just kind of popped out of my mouth before really thinking about what that might mean for me. And I said, do you want to write a novel together? And Matt said, sure, immediately.
Oh, I love that, that it popped out of your mouth because, I mean, you know, for fiction writers, isn't that sometimes, you know, what happens? We don't know why, but it just comes out. And then before you know it, we have a novel.
Yeah, it was a little bit longer than that, but yes.
Right. How long?
A few years to get the novel, but.
And Matt, if I were to ask you the same question, how would you answer it?
Well, I mean, I've been thinking a little bit about writing prior to this, and you know, as I was sitting in lab and looking out at the Wasatch Mountains in Salt Lake City and thinking how beautiful it was out there, and I was stuck in here, and how you could write anywhere.
Wow.
So you know, the dream was there, but in reality, I'm terribly dyslexic. It's not something that I would writing on my own has always been something that it was deathly afraid of in one sense. But I also, the idea of literature and story is very organic to me since we grew up in a family that put reading and put these things as a priority despite my own struggles with reading and not being able to read until I was 10. The long story short, I would not probably have had the guts to say, yeah, I'm going to write this. But knowing that Jessica had my back, which she's had it in the past, there was no hesitation there. I was like, yeah, I mean, I think this could work out really well in my mind.
So, Matt, why don't you tell Daniel about your ideas that you were having for what you were going to write when you were in the lab?
Oh, right. So, I've always been a musical person. I play multiple instruments, and I love that type of thing. So in my head, I actually was envisioning a musical based in a hardcore science lab with, and my chorus would be either lab mice or lab monkeys, and they would dance across the stage between scenes and sing about this life. So
I love that
a musical based on a lab experience would be pretty funny, especially because it's a very hierarchical situation.
Oh, wow.
And there's definitely stereotypes there that are good for people to see, and both for the reality and for the fact that they're stereotypes and are totally untrue.
Right. That's interesting because I think I can imagine myself as a kid, like maybe if I had to go mow the lawn or something, I would suddenly be like an Oliver Twist-like character and I'd be singing, I have to mow the lawn. And I wonder if writers or just creative people in general do that. Matt, this is your first novel. It's a beautiful novel, man. I was so engaged right from the beginning. It's a great debut for you. And I'm going to ask you, though, the question that every novelist gets, and it's probably the worst question a novelist could get, and I'm sorry to subject you to it, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What is your novel Broken Circle about?
It is, in a nutshell, 15-year-old Adam. He wants to be a normal kid, things aren't going very well for him. He's not entirely sure why he isn't quite having normal experiences and just having his life working out like he would hope. And of course, turns out that his destiny and his life is entwined within helping souls cross from life to death after they die. And so it's kind of this revealing life and coming of age of a young man, which I think is kind of funny, who is deathly afraid of death.
Right.
And that he's going to have to, this is his life calling, basically, is that he's going to have to deal with this.
Yeah, at one point, I read an interview with you, and at one point you were talking about how the book came about. You were in a coffee shop, I forget where, and you were thinking of death, and you started to think of the idea of death as failure. Can you explain what you mean by that and how that led you to Adam's story?
Sure. So when we were contemplating making a move from Minnesota here to Maine, my wife had a job interview, and in Brunswick, Maine, and I was sitting at this coffee shop thinking absolutely about a totally different short story at the time. And this idea came to me that we were moving. We basically had this failure in Minnesota. We moved there with the family to be near other family, and we were going to be in this great little town, and Annie was going to practice medicine. None of this worked out for us. The town didn't fit us. The practice was very poorly run, and we realized that despite what we wanted, this was going to not be a good idea, and it was a failure, and we were going to have to move away from people that we specifically moved towards, and everybody, there's this death that comes with having to say goodbye to this dream that you have. And I was thinking about why do we think of failure as like a death? And yes, you do these mourning things, and it came to me that like in our Judaic Christian worldview, we think of death as like the ultimate failure.
I know, which is weird if you would think about it. If we're going to die and go to heaven and be with God, it should not be so, you know, horrible.
Yeah, but I think also if you think about, in a way, we equate sin with death, right? We wouldn't die. That's the other idea, right? There would not have been death if we had not fallen in the Garden of Eden, and we fell by causing sin. And so we've always had this idea that sin and death
are,
and so you're a moral failure for dying.
The wages of sin is death.
Exactly, and so it's a moral. It's this moral. It's not just a death. In a way, in our subconscious, we also have this idea that we are a moral failure.
If we aren't
healthy, wealthy people.
And you have a PhD in oncological science, and I don't really know much about it other than it has to do with the study of cancer. But I'm wondering if that field in particular gives you the opportunity to think a lot about death.
Well, you do, because you come to realization. I was working on breast cancer in particular, and there are certain types of breast cancer that when you get them, your outlook is basically, you know, 99.99% of people who have that particular cancer or recurrence of cancer are going to die, right? And that's just a statistical, you know, like in your face thing. Yes, we're trying to come up with ways of treating it, but most likely you're not going to survive this.
And so in many ways, the field that you entered is something that Adam does. It's really leading somebody from life into death.
It is, but it's in a way, and I think there's a hope to that in the sense that in our world that we've created, you know, you have to come to terms with the life that you've lived in limbo. And there's somebody there to help you with that, right? And I guess that is part of thinking about cancer as a whole thing, right? It's not just that you are going to fight cancer and you're going to live, right? That is a possibility.
Right.
But there's also a statistical possibility that you will fight cancer and you will die. But that doesn't mean you're a moral failure.
Right, absolutely.
It does not mean that you did not make every choice as a rational, whole person that you could have up to that point, right? Or that if you had just believed a little bit harder, you would have survived. You know, so as a scientist, when I look at that, it's almost like, no, you have nothing to do with this. You have a disease, and now you've died,
or
you are going to die. How can you make that last?
I'm talking to J.L. Powers and M.A. Powers, brother and sister novelist team. Their first novel together is called Broken Circle. It's a wonderful story about this boy who has this ability to see on both sides of life and death and who brings the living. And it is really his job. He soon discovers, or his purpose is to guide people into death. And there's a lot of ideas about what happens after death that come up, the roles of angels or demons or spiritual entities such as the Grim Reaper or the Angel of Death. And I'm wondering how much you guys research these particular traditions. Did you research a lot? And are the ideas of what happens at the moment of death and the characters, are they based on some particular tradition, or is it just kind of an amalgamation of various traditions and creativity?
Well, we did do research because one of the things that we were thinking about was how do these different icons in all cultures around the world, these icons of death, whether it's the Grim Reaper or the Irish Dullahan figure or the Scottish Kusith figure or the Shinigami in Japanese culture, cultures around the world have these different icons of death, and they mean different things in different cultures. And so we did do research about those different figures, but in the end, I think we didn't try and stay necessarily true to all of the ideals built into each of those icons, because those icons have varied meanings too. You know, I mean, you take the Grim Reaper, and how can you possibly define what he symbolically means? Historically, over the past, you know, he apparently emerged during the Middle Ages. You know, how can you possibly consider the varied meanings that he had? And so what we had to think about was how these figures, who are much more like the Greek figure of Charon rowing dead people across the river Styx, they're not going out and killing people. They're not little assassins, right? They're actually trying to help people reconcile themselves to the life they live so that they can pass peacefully on to the other side, whatever the other side is. And so we tried to figure out, you know, what these historical traditions around these particular figures mean. And we tried to think about how different cultures approach death and how these figures might be in opposition to that in some regard, right? So if in Western society we fear death, we see death as a failure, we try and fight and fight and fight to live as long as possible, you know, even to the point of, you know, these people that pay to get frozen so that they can later be resurrected again.
Right. Or that Kurzweil guy who takes, like, what, 100 vitamins and pills a day, thinking he's going to stay alive long enough to be able to do that.
Right. So in opposition to that, our figures understand that death is inevitable, and that rather than, you know, fighting it when your time comes, how can you reconcile yourself to the life that you lived and go on peacefully. And so, and that's going to look different for every single person, since every single person has an individual experience through life and individual problems that they face. And so we did do research into these figures, and because we're bringing up, you know, these figures from different cultures around the world, because the U.S. is a multicultural society, and, you know, we didn't want to have just one figure. It's just not just the Grim Reaper. You know, we have people from cultures all around the world that live here. And so we had, therefore, Grim Reaper figures from around the world who are assisting people. And so we did look carefully at that, and we looked at how different cultures approach death. You know, the Mexican ideas of death are very different. Right. The celebration of spirits, the Day of the Dead, and other things. You know, we are taking all of those traditions into account and those beliefs into account, but at the same time, our actual figures, because they're fantasies, right? In one sense, we had to kind of go beyond that and create something new.
Right. You know, all this talk about death, all this talk about all this philosophical talk about death, it reflects the book in a sense, but it doesn't, because what's fantastic about this book, you can have as many great ideas and philosophical approaches to death, you know, that would fill volumes, but it would just be boring reading. The fact is, this book is a page turner. And I mean, right from the beginning, you want to know what's going to go on. There's a lot of mystery. Everything is, you know, it's not all revealed at once, a little at a time, until you're completely absorbed into this world that contains both the world that we know of as the world of the living and the world of the dead, and even some other weird kind of strange places. It's a really fantastic novel. It's a page turner. How did you guys achieve this? What was the process like? Did one of you write a chapter and then the other one looked it over and then you switch off like that? Or tell us about the process.
Matt?
So I think it was definitely a word machine, in the sense that it would go through both of our minds no matter who wrote it first.
Uh-huh.
And so there's nothing in the book that's necessarily we can point to and say that's absolutely mine or that's absolutely Jessica's.
It's
a little odd and probably more intense than most people would ever want to do.
So you would write a chapter, for example, and then she'd send it to her, and then she would write a chapter and send it to you. Did you work chronologically?
No.
Yeah.
So
nope.
it wasn't even as clean as writing a whole chapter and sending it. It was, you know, writing scenes, and the scenes might not even be chronological, and then sending it to the other person. One person would jump ahead. We're actually writing book two in the series right now.
Nice.
And so it's similar. We're right in the middle of this exact same process where, you know, Matt kind of wrote some of the earlier scenes, and I'm now going through and revising and kind of adding transitions in between and adding scenes in between. So it's working. And right now I think Matt's writing the very ending, even though there's this chunk in the middle that hasn't been written yet.
That's what I was going to ask you next. Did you know how this novel was going to end when you started writing it?
I would say no, not at all.
And so it surprised you.
I've never been good at outlining. It's always a process of feeling my way towards.
Right, but there's a difference between knowing the end and outlining. Because a lot of times writers will start with the end in mind, but they don't have any idea how they're going to get there or what's going to happen.
I think for this particular book, we didn't exactly know how this was going to end. We have an overall arc for the series, and so we know very big, broadly, what is going to happen in the series and kind of how the series is going to end. But that actual, the first book, I think was difficult to know when to say, okay, this is it for this particular story.
And we discovered things about our characters in this first book that, as readers, you won't know yet, but it's in there. And over the course of the series, those things will be revealed. But as a reader of just the first book and not knowing, you don't know those things. But we discovered them as we wrote this, and I was like, okay, do we reveal that in this book, or do we wait?
See, I love that language when a writer says, you know, I discovered, because one of the things that makes this a page-turner is all the different surprises. And they're so organic that it seems like the writers must have been surprised at times when they put in this novel together.
We sure were.
Yes. And there's some, the stuff that we took out at the end was a surprise too. So there you have it.
The main character, Adam, before he realizes or learns his family calling as a high school student, he has this ability to seize people's shadows. He sees the shadows of everybody, and shadows say a lot about a person and how they act. Can you tell us a little bit about the shadows?
You go ahead, Jessica.
Sure. So I should say that Adam's ability to see people's shadows is his ability to kind of see their soul and what kind of person they are. And our other teen soul guides that will appear in other books have actually different abilities to see souls. So they all have kind of slightly different ways of being able to interpret the information that's coming to them that is beyond just a visual sighting of a person. And for Adam, you know, he really can see what a person is, the core essence of who they are, by seeing their shadow. And, you know, I don't know if Matt's aware of this, but I think came to this a little bit from reading The Princess and Curdie by George MacDonald. I haven't read that book since I was a kid, but when I was probably 8 or 9, I read that book, and Curdie ends up getting this ability to, you know, he goes through this very painful process where his skin is peeled layer by layer until he has this, you know, this very tender.
Yeah, I remember this.
This very tender skin. And when he shakes somebody's hand, he can tell whether this person is becoming a beast or if this person was a beast and is now becoming more human-like, right? Like, he can literally tell the process that this human is going through. Are they becoming more evil or becoming better as a human? So that kind of came to me to think about these shadows and how Adam sees somebody's soul.
Yeah, that was one. I love that part when we see a character and then I'm, you know, after a while I'm thinking, okay, what's their shadow look like? Because it tells so much about them, and it's really is wonderful. I'm wondering, are you represented? Do you have an agent for this book?
I do have an agent, but we went ahead with this particular book and series are unagented.
Because the reason why I ask is because this would make a fantastic movie. Any efforts to try to make this a movie?
Well, our publisher, Akashic Books, does occasionally, work to make movie deals. So we can certainly hope. And if you have any leads, let us know.
Film it myself. No, it would really make a fantastic movie. There's so much creativity, creative images, just incredible things that happen in this world. This is also marketed or considered a YA book. And I'm wondering if you were aware of the genre as you were writing it, or did you send it to the publisher and they said that that's how we're going to put it out in the world?
Well, I think we're both pretty hardcore young adult fans. So I think we were specifically thinking of it as being YA in that terms when we started writing it, as to like what kind of a genre it would be in. I mean, that's always tough, and I think it's getting harder and harder in young adult literature to say what genre anything is.
Yeah, no, I agree. I don't necessarily think of young adult fiction as a genre itself. It's more about the audience.
Right,
but within
right,
that,
good
there's
point. Yeah.
Horror or fantasy or romance, et cetera, just like there is in adult fiction. And interestingly, young adult fiction these days, I would say probably 50% of its audience are adults.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Benjamin Sines, who we both know and care for deeply, writes YA novels, and I would imagine over 50% of his readers are adults.
Absolutely.
Because just because they're YA books doesn't mean that they lack anything. I mean, they're just young characters that would appeal to young readers.
Right. It's
genre is problematic. Absolutely. I totally agree.
It's an audience that is changing, transformationally changing how we approach those books, because, 10 years ago, you wouldn't ever have a young adult book that had sort of an adult retrospective or chapters from adults, or very rarely. But now, people are beginning to do that. They might have a character who's a teen and a character who's an adult and have chapters from the adult. So it's an audience that's really in transition right now.
Absolutely.
And I'm beginning to wonder if the boundaries are becoming so
blurred that you can take some, quote, literary adult novels and give it a YA name and it would be the same novel.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah. And that's why it's problematic to call it a genre. You're right. And I wouldn't even give this one a genre, except to say that it is a page turner. It is a fantastic, beautifully written book. We care about Adam and we love being dragged along with him into this new and exciting experience. J.L. Powers and M.A. Powers, authors of Broken Circle. Jessica and Matt, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Hey, thank you
for having us.
I'd like to thank JL and MA for joining me here on Words on a Wire. The book is, like I said, it's the kind of book that you could enter into and linger for a while. It's a fantastic imaginative world that you're going to enter if you read Broken Circle. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank our producer, Lauren Terrazas, and I'll see you next week here on Words on a Wire.